Tonight, I'd like to have us reflect a bit about being a Christian in an uncertain America, in an America come unglued, as I sometimes call it, and to understand a dimension of the gospel that I think is directly relevant to what it means to live in a time of a lot of uncertainty, a lot of insecurity, a lot of free-floating anxiety, when people are, on the one hand, drifting into a kind of privatism and relativism, and on the other hand, they are moving toward forms of political and religious authoritarianism, looking for certain and sure answers that provide a certain measure of assumed security. And tonight I'd like to have us think about the topic, the gospel as the invitation to embrace an uncertainty. That is to say, my thesis is that part of the meaning of the call to become a disciple of Jesus is precisely to do that, to become a disciple, and to follow along a way, a path. And therefore, to follow means to accept the unknown, the unexplored, the unsure, the uncertain. It is to embrace uncertainty. It is to accept anxiety. And so rather than running from anxiety, the gospel is a call to accept it and to embrace it. And I think the old-fashioned word for that is faith. I mean, that's what faith is. Faith is not serenity and security. Faith is a kind of life courage that enables us to live in a world that is unfinished, changing, unstable, turbulent, even treacherous, and to be able to go out with good courage and to follow the one who leads us. So that's my overall thesis, and I'd like to develop it a little bit then. First, it might help for us to think about the whole notion of crisis. Some of you may know how Chinese language works, and some of you may even know about the Chinese character for crisis. The Chinese language is not written with letters in an alphabet, but is written by certain ideographs. That is, a certain kind of almost picture is drawn that connotes an entire term. And these Chinese characters have certain radicals in them, certain major kind of elements. And you can put these radicals together and therefore create interesting kinds of words by putting two thoughts together. And that's what the Chinese have done with the term crisis. Their ideogram for crisis is the combination of two other ideograms. The one is the ideogram for danger, and the other is the ideogram for opportunity. So a crisis is a danger opportunity. And you see the sense of that. That's what a crisis is. So a crisis is not necessarily all bad. Yes, there are dangers. Yes, there are perils. Yes, there is turbulence, pain, loss, even tragedy. But yet there is also opportunity. And I think that is something that we ought to reflect about when we sense that we're living in a time of crisis, whether that's a personal crisis, an interpersonal family or marital crisis, whether it's a community crisis or a national crisis or international crisis. A time when the times become turbulent and our world starts to come apart and we feel that sense of crisis, we ought to remember, I think, that Chinese character. This is, yes, danger, but it's also opportunity. Now, in this, I don't want to romanticize crisis because it does include danger. It does include the negative. And I think back in the 60s, there were certain people who tended to romanticize crisis and change. There was an assumption that all stability was repressive and that all change would inevitably be for the better. We discover that that is really not true. I think that for every advance we make in life, there also are losses, and I think we all know this. You gain measures of maturity, but you give up certain things. You know, you gain the wisdom of older age, but you lose the spontaneity of your youth. You learn to be self-qualified and careful about things, and you're knowledgeable, but you lose a certain kind of naivete, fresh, childlike naivete. You can't have it all. We can't have it all. See? So that change is not always for the better. Change can be painful. And sometimes we think that change is going to inevitably bring something beneficial. I think we have to think about that. My wife and I have picked up our roots, and we've moved to Columbus 5 years ago, and there we're gradually building a new life for ourselves. And we're happy to be there. It's a good place to be. I feel that my teaching at the seminary, I'm in sync with that. I enjoy my work, but it has been painful for us. There have been losses. And I think I've even mentioned this in the series a while back. I think of picking up and moving to a new job or a new town or something like that, like transplanting a tree. You ball up the earth around the root system and move it, but really what you've done is you've cut off a lot of roots and you've left them behind. And I think the older you get, the more roots are there, and you feel the loss of that living tissue that remains back there, and you can never pick it up again, and you cannot maintain continuity with it. And there is pain and loss, and I don't think that we should deny that, and I don't think we should avoid recognizing that. So to just assume that change is always for the better, I think we ought to think twice about that. We can find things coming so unglued that the situation invites chaos. And often in that chaos, if we don't have any kind of basic stability, we really get thrown around by things, and we soon find ourselves subject to the tyranny of the latest fad that comes along, or the latest whim. That's one of the things that sometimes we don't understand. St. Augustine understood that really well. He said, in effect, that freedom is not the lack of restrictions, but comes within the acceptance of restrictions. That's when you have real freedom. If the world is totally open to you in all directions, it really is chaotic, and you really don't have any keel or rudder to move by. And you just are tossed about by anything that comes along. And that's hardly fulfilling human freedom. So freedom always is tied to limits and restrictions. So I think we ought to be qualified about change. And a little word from Edmund Burke might be helpful here. He said that where change is not necessary, it should not be sought. If change isn't necessary, don't do it. And parish pastors, please take note as you're mucking about with the liturgy. Now, I am very enthusiastic about the New Lutheran Book of Worship. I even helped introduce it in the Red River Valley Synod of the LCA, where I was a pastor and where I was teaching at the time. I think that it is a great resource, but I think it must be done carefully, and you must know why you're introducing it. It's not just changing the color of a book from red to green, or just causing confusion in the ranks of the congregation, or just trying to jazz them up or shake them up. And if that's your motivation, don't bother. Leave things alone. Don't change unless you find a very important reason to introduce change. And I think that's something we Americans need to understand as we keep ripping our world apart and remaking it. I had an old Irish granduncle who used to say, "Ah, to be sure, New York is a great place, if ever they'd finish it." You know, I mean, that's sort of how it is. I mean, it would be a great place if ever we got this thing finished. This kind of ripping down our world and rebuilding it again is not always automatically for the better. But yet, it is also true, and here's the dialectical balance, yet it's also true that disruption and change are necessary if we as persons are to gain measures of maturity and wisdom. It just doesn't come any other way. It's only when our lives are disrupted, It's only when our foundations are shaken that we begin to ask very important and very radical questions. That's the only time we begin to say, what is my life adding up to anyway? Who am I? What do I want from life? What is this marriage really all about? What is the business of being in a family really all about? Am I really wanting to pour my life into this particular kind of occupation for the rest of the days that I have? See? These very significant formative questions, and questions more about one's own identity. Who am I? What do I really want? Those tend to occur in times of questioning, uneasiness, disruption, the breaking up of the ordinary routine, and even times of crisis. And these questions, I think, ultimately are the genuinely religious questions, because beneath them all are the thematic religious questions. What does life really amount to? From what do we come? To what do we belong? Where are we all headed? What does it all add up to in the long run? What really matters? What can I depend upon? What is it worth loving and caring about? Those are the fundamental religious questions, and we don't ask those questions until our life becomes disrupted. And in this respect, I think this is something of the meaning of the term repentance in both the Old and the New Testaments. It's not the whole of it, but I think it's an important part of it. Repentance is not, as we ordinarily think, feeling remorseful and terrible about oneself, having a very poor self-image, or putting oneself down for being reprehensible. The real root of metanoia, as it's called in the New Testament, means to reorient oneself, to kind of move off in a new direction, to kind of grab a hold of oneself and take stock of things and then begin to chart a new course. And I think this is beautifully illustrated in Jesus' parable of the prodigal son, where we have the son in the far distant country having a good time, and then the bottom falls out and he's in a time of danger opportunity, right? Crisis. And in that danger opportunity, the opportunity comes through, and Jesus says in his parable, and he came to himself and said, dot, dot, dot. Isn't that a wonderful phrase? And he came to himself. He got in touch with himself. He got in touch with who he was and what was going on. He got in touch with the issues that matter, with the questions that really matter. And then what happens? He sets off, literally, in a new direction. But the setting off in a geographical direction is also the sign of setting off in a new spiritual, psychological, relational direction. This person is finding himself in a new way. And that is the heart of repentance, of metanoia. It is to take stock of oneself and to come to grips with what is happening and to then move off in a new direction. And so that is the key to repentance, and that is why crisis is not necessarily a bad thing, because it can be a time of taking stock of oneself, of asking some fundamental questions, of coming to oneself and moving off in new directions. So it is that although crises, I do not think, are necessarily good in and of themselves, they are not always benevolent in their intention or their impact or results. Nevertheless, as Christians, we can dare to affirm with St. Paul that we can accept these crises from God's hands, even if God doesn't create them. We can take them as if they come to us from God's hands and seek to find out what we can learn within them and how we can grow and what changes are necessary for us in our life. And therefore, we can affirm with St. Paul in Romans 8:28, that all things, even the negative things, even the turbulent and uncertain things, all things work together for good to those who love God and are called according to his purposes. So the key is to love God, to seek God's will, and to be open to the claims and promises of God, and to be attuned to a divine vision of what life is all about, so that we are called according to His purposes and not just our own. And if we can sense that in a moment of crisis, when the bottom falls out, no matter what it is, financial reversal, marital disruption, our society seeming to come unglued, a younger generation that we can't understand and that seems to have abandoned everything we consider to be important, even holy and moral, in those moments, those things can work together for good if we learn how to understand God's impact in them, calling us to ourselves, calling us to take stock of what really matters and who we are and where we're going. And therefore, these crises can come to us not because God causes them to happen. I mean, that's what a monstrous deity that is, you know. There's a certain kind of naive pietism that says, this is the will of God, you know, and your child is dying of cancer. This is God's will. What kind of a monster is this? Or there's some terrible accident or whatever, and this is God's will. Well, maybe for you, but as for me, I'll give that kind of a God a very strong argument. In good Jewish fashion, I'll complain a lot. Like Job does, you know. What's going on here? And the same with the Jewish people following the Holocaust they suffered from the Nazis. You mean God does this to His people? Like the Hungarian Jews said as they were being carted off to Auschwitz, let somebody else be the chosen people for a while. We're tired of it. And for good reason, you know. I mean, if this is the will of God. But no, it is not that God causes these things to happen, but it is rather to receive them, wherever they are, whatever causes them, to receive them as coming from God's hands, in the sense that we seek then to be open to the possibilities of creation and recreation at God's hands in the midst of these sometimes even very terrible and traumatic moments. So therefore, we Christians speak not about fate, but about providence. We don't live in a world in which God is pulling a lot of fatalistic strings, making the things happen that happen. The world is full of a lot of creaturely freedom, especially a lot of human freedom. But within that, there is divine providence. There is a kind of wisdom, and there is a kind of creativity at work that's able to use even the negativities of the world, even things like Good Fridays, and make something else out of them. And so, that is how I think we can begin to think how we approach times of uncertainty, disruption, anxiety, and crisis. This is danger, opportunity. But the opportunities there ultimately are not just our own, but they're ultimately providential. They are the opportunities of God's presence and Spirit to be at work in us, to shape us anew, and to make us into wiser, more tempered, more mature, and ultimately more loving and compassionate people, and more courageous and faithful people. Therefore, I think that in times of uncertainty, we have to recognize that what it means to be a human being is to accept anxiety. Remember, we looked at anxiety sessions ago. Anxiety is being basic to our being human. We can't escape it, that we are both the creatures of limitation on the one hand and freedom on the other hand. You can never escape either one of them. And we're always trying to do that. That's our sin. We're always trying to be more than human or less than human, and sometimes trying to do both at the same time. But to live in the world is to be human, and therefore to accept the givenness of anxiety. That our life is open-ended, and yet at the same time, it is closed to us. There are things that we cannot do anything about. And we have to learn to find our way within that, in a kind of creative and faithful humanness. And I think that this is captured so beautifully in a prayer that Reinhold Niebuhr once wrote, that has been picked up and used by Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon and other self-help and mutual support groups. And the prayer is, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. That prayer is a prayer saying, help me to accept my limits, and help me to affirm my freedom, and help me to know where my limits are and where my freedom is. That's what that prayer is saying. It's a prayer asking the Spirit of God to deliver us from the power of our sin, which has us try to escape both limitations and freedom. So it seems to me that in this instance, to accept anxiety means a certain kind of radical honesty. We can afford to be really honest with ourselves, to begin to try to find out where our real strength is, and also where our real weaknesses are. To recognize that life is indeed open-ended. The doors are not all shut. There are all kinds of open doors in any and every situation, even if it's only one's attitude. I can remember reading a diary of a Jewish woman in Auschwitz who was there as a young woman, and she was so overwhelmed by the horror of the place and the incredible delimitation that was placed upon her as a human being. She was dehumanized, as all the inmates were at every point. She was trapped, she was helpless, but she struggled to find the point where she could exercise her freedom. And her freedom was found in her attitude. I refuse to let them force me to cry. I refuse to let them make me cry. I will not cry. That I can do. So in a situation of incredible delimitation, she found that one open door of freedom in which she could preserve her humanity. So that's the courage to change the things one can, to change one's attitude, to change one's outlook, to change one's internal response. And then after the liberation, she broke down and she wept. She wept for all those years, for all those experiences. But during that time, she could maintain her sense of her own human identity by exercising that little spark of freedom. So to accept that, and simultaneously with that, to accept the world as tragic. This world is filled with tragedy. The limitations that come to us many times are imposed upon us in terrible ways. But that's the world in which we live and not another one. And the call is to accept both the open doors of our lives and also the limits of our lives, even when they are tragic. To recognize our capacity for achievement and to recognize as well our genuine failures. To see our own personal and corporate greatness, and to see our own personal and corporate guilt. It means to accept the world that we are in and not ask for a different one. Now, that, I think, it sounds so simple, but I think that's the hardest thing to do, to accept the world as it is, in terms of both its limitations and its freedom. But I think that's at the very heart of a Christian perspective on existence, because the God whom we affirm is the God who is revealed in the incarnation, in the Christ who stands in our midst in this world and who enters it and who lives out his life and finds his ministry within the world as it is. And therefore, to see oneself in the light of this Christ means being given the encouragement to be honest. This God knows us and the world for what we are, and accepts us and affirms us, treasures us, and I will even strongly say, needs us because God needs us as we are and where we are. So faith, therefore, is an active process of living out one's life in the world the way it is, with all of the danger and all of the opportunity. This is precisely what it means to die and rise with Christ. Paul says that's what it means to be baptized. In our baptism, we have died and we have risen with Christ. And Luther says every day we're to renew our baptism and to die and rise with Christ every day. Well, in what sense? To die with Christ means to put to death our illusions, our wants, our wanting life to be different, our wanting the situation in which we find ourselves to be different, and complaining all the time, or playing games with ourselves. And remember, I looked at this, how our illusions are based on our wishes, how we want the world to be shaped in a certain kind of way, how we want things to come out in a certain kind of a pattern. And our wishes are so strong that we keep looking for that, and we even develop religious systems around those illusions. A God who's going to bail us out, a God who's going to deliver us, a God who's going to save us from problems. I mean, those deities are alive and well, and boy, do they sell. They're right there on the tube, just like Colgate toothpaste, you know. These deities are very powerful commodities because there's a wonderful market out there for deities that are going to solve all your problems or keep you from having problems in the first place. And then, you know, there are all those testimonies. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was in such financial trouble, and I prayed to the Lord, and I took it to the Lord in prayer, and lo and behold, my Aunt Harriet dropped dead out there in California and left me $250,000. Glory be to Jesus. You know, those kinds of deities are, I mean, they're wonderful. They've always had a big crowd. I mean, the name for it back in the Old Testament was Baal. Baal. Those were the gods of the Greco-Roman world. You know? But then along comes this Yahweh and says, Moses says, listen, tell me your name. Tell me what you're all about. And he says, tell him my name is Yahweh. And there are various ways of translating it, but one of the more imaginative that I've heard of is, I'll be what I want to be. No controls. No strings, people. Are you willing to take a chance and follow? Are you willing to take a risk? I'm going to do weird things. You know, you're going to leave Egypt, you're going to leave slavery behind, but you're also going to leave behind that wonderful food. You're going to end up in the wilderness eating potatoes. Well, what were you expecting for supper tonight? Manna and honey and water from the rock? Wild locusts? I mean, it's a risk. You want to take a risk? Jesus comes along and says, follow me. And that's a risk. You know, there's even volunteer. Oh, take me. I volunteer. Let me be your disciple. Jesus says, you don't know what you're asking. The foxes have their dens and the birds of the air have their nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. You're going to follow a road. You're not going to know where it's going to end up. Are you willing to just take a flyer and just kind of follow me out into a world that's unfinished and uncertain? But that is faith. Faith is an active process. It is dying and rising with Christ. It's putting to death our illusions, setting aside our wishes and our wants, and accepting life the way it is from God's hand. And rising means being given life in a new way. That same life, that ordinary human life, now comes to us in a new way because we are accepting it from the hands of God, and we find that there is a strength greater than our own that's supporting us, and there's a wisdom deeper than our own that is guiding us, and there is a power more fundamental and ultimate than our own that's shaping us. You know, there's something loose in this world. It's the presence of God. And when we really risk ourselves and reach out to that, that's when we begin to be changed. And that's when we begin to mature. grow up into Christ, say the apostles and the saints of all the ages. It's a matter of growing up into something bigger than you. There is something bigger than you out there, and you can grow up into it if you are willing to risk yourself and let go of your petty securities and your illusions, and willingness have a willingness to be open. What Jesus promises his disciples is not security. He does not promise his disciples happiness. He does not promise them contentedness. He promises them something more powerful and deeper than that. He promises them blessedness. And why is blessedness more powerful and more ultimate than happiness or security or contentedness? Happiness cannot embrace unhappiness. Security cannot handle insecurity. Contentedness cannot handle discontent. But blessedness can encompass all of them without being destroyed by them. Isn't that so? Isn't that what faith can do? It isn't that the troubles or the difficulties or the limitations go away, but rather there is something that is able to embrace them and transcend them. Jesus doesn't escape crucifixion. He embraces crucifixion, but is more than crucifixion. That's how it works. So Jesus promises us blessedness. He promises a life that is truly alive. And we are only really alive when we live in this world with all of its dangers and all of its opportunities. I mean, that's what makes life lively, isn't it? You take away all the danger, take away all the opportunity, and let's face it, it's as dull as dishwater. It's really rather uninteresting stuff. No, he promises us life and life more abundantly precisely because he calls us to a life that includes within it all of the dangers and all of the opportunities. And this is a richer life than a life that's found in running away and trying to play it safe and finding some little niche of security and certainty. Now, this might sound a little abstract, but I think that it's verified right and left. You just have to open your eyes to see it. Who are the people that you know who have a measure of real understanding and compassion and a capacity to reach out and touch your life and to have a strength there that you can somehow feel and that give you some measure of comfort and support when times are tough for you? Think of those people. I would bet anything that those are people who have known tough times and pain themselves. Now, what's interesting is that it doesn't work the other way around. Not everybody who goes through tough times and suffers pain ends up being wise, strong, compassionate, understanding. They can end up being complaining, self-pitying, and bitter. So it doesn't work the other way around. But it does seem to be the case that the people who have that kind of strength and who have it there and offer it to other people are people who have really gone through some tough stuff themselves. They have life, and they have it more abundantly because their lives have been able to embrace the dangers and the opportunities in a power and strength that is greater than their own. They know something of the blessedness, that the abundant life that Jesus promises. And Jesus says God keeps his promises. In this regard, I think it's interesting to think of the figure of Jesus and the character of his ministry He said that he came not for those who are healthy, but for those who are sick. Therefore, everybody who considers himself healthy, strong, or as we would say in recent jargon, together, you know, the person who really has life together, don't bother. Don't check it out with me. You don't need me, obviously. You know, you know how to handle life on your own. You have it all together. You have control. Therefore, you don't need me. I'm only here for the people who don't have, know that, that they don't have the control. For those who are troubled, and those who are uncertain, and those who are ill, and those who are uncomfortable with themselves. I'm here for you. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that the people who thought that they had their life together and really thought that they had a control on things are precisely the people who ended up hating Jesus and wanting him killed. It's kind of interesting. Why should they get so upset? He wasn't really giving them a hard time. He said, don't worry about it. I'm not here for you. I'm just here for the people who know that they need me. That's all. So if you don't need me, don't worry about it. But they end up getting angry. Why? Because the way in which he interacts with them, he begins to let them know that they don't have it as together as they think. That they're not as much in control as they like to think they are. You got all the answers figured out? Stick around Jesus a little while, and then you begin to discover you have more questions than you have answers. Very troubling. Or those who think they have moral control.
Well, at least I have my dignity and my self-respect.
Well, fine. Very good. I'm glad to hear that you really, you're in control of things. Wonderful. Therefore, sell all that you have and give it to the poor. And therefore, of course, you have no lust in your heart. No, because if you lust in your heart, you already have committed adultery. But of course, you don't do those things. And of course, you never say anything nasty to your neighbor, like, you idiot. Even quietly to yourself. I mean, you don't do those things because you know that if you say, you idiot, about one of your neighbors, you obviously are guilty of murder because you are filled with hatred and alienation. You've already committed murder in your heart. But you know this, and of course, you don't do these things. You have it all together, don't you? You have it. You're in control. You don't need me. I understand that. Fine. And so sell all that you have, give it to the poor, be anxious for nothing. And of course, when somebody hits you, you turn the other cheek because you're really a very loving person, right? And you automatically do that, right? And you don't get angry or upset? Of course. So you don't need me. You see what's happening? He's making people furious because he's revealing to them that they don't have control. And they don't have it all together. And they do, in fact, need him and what he embodies and witnesses to, which is grace. The people who have all the answers are the people who strain at gnats and swallow camels. The people who have all the answers and say, the Bible says, and therefore they have a closed and tight and secure world and have all the answers there, are those who have the letter, but not the Spirit. Jesus says, if you want to follow me, it means discipleship. It means life on the road. It means risking things and setting out, recognizing you don't have control. Are you willing to do that? Are you willing to admit the fact that you don't have control? And are you willing to follow me? That's what Jesus is about. Now, more quickly, since I think that's the heart of it, in this regard, I think there are certain secular allies of faith. Now, secular humanists are always being taken pot shots. I want to stand up as a Christian theologian for secular humanists. I think that in many ways, not in all ways, but in many ways, they can actually be allies of the understanding of faith that I've been trying to sketch out here. Why? Because one of the geniuses of secular humanism is human beings don't have everything figured out. That's why secular humanism encourages things like open debate, differences of opinion, lots of tolerance, and lots of free thought. They encourage a society that's built like that. They encourage a public school system that's built like that. And that's why they like the sciences. And that's just why those who want control and security don't like the secular humanists, because they don't like tolerance, they don't like differences of opinion, they don't like open-ended kinds of questions, and they don't like science. Why? Because they like control. Because they like certainty and security with everything boxed in. They don't want to set out on the road. What's interesting about these secular types is that without even acknowledging God necessarily, they live on the road. And some of them live on the road in an interesting kind of a way that I find, as a Christian theologian, very fascinating. An atheist or agnostic scientist says, I'm committed to the truth. I find that fascinating. Committed to the truth. Truth greater than yourself. That's right. A truth that no one has figured out. That's right. I put myself onto that truth and I follow it wherever it goes. Bravo. As a Christian, I can only say bravo. And this is, I'm not saying anything new. The ancient theologian said this. St. Augustine said this. I mean, St. Augustine always used to sit around and recognize people following the claims of the good, the claims of the true, the claims of the meaningful, the claims of the humane, and they're out following that. Where does that ultimately come from? Is the truth, the ultimate truth, anything less than God? Is the ultimate claims of goodness and of humanity anything less than God? See? That in their own way they are responding to the quiet voice of God built into the world. They haven't heard the fullness of that voice in Jesus Christ, but they still have heard something of the voice of God, because this whole world and the whole of human life belongs to God. It doesn't belong to anybody else. So, therefore, you know, these secular humanist types, I'm not endorsing them. I'm not just giving them an unqualified seal of good churchkeeping here.
They don't want it either.
No, they wouldn't be interested. But they're interesting types to me, because I think they have a lot going. And therefore, I think the whole business of tolerance, open-endedness, the willingness to question and probe, being honest about one's questions and one's doubts, placing yourself under the claim of a truth and a goodness larger than yourself, these things are that to which we can say a hearty amen. And remember, I quoted St. Augustine the other day to the effect that when he said, there is much outside the church that belongs to Christ, just as there is much inside the church that does not belong to Christ. Okay. So, the commitment of certain secularists and humanists to a something paralleling a life of discipleship is really, for us, an ally of faith. And therefore, I think we ought to speak out on their behalf and recognize the value and the contributions that they're making to the whole of human history in trying to keep human beings open and alive and searching and humble. And then I think we can then reaffirm that and see that in a particular context that is given to us in Christ. We also see in this the health of accepting limits. That's part and parcel of mental and emotional health. Psychotherapy is pointing to that over and over again. Karen Horney, the great psychoanalyst, said, every neurotic that I have encountered is a personality that has refused to accept real limits. I mean, that's the nature of neurosis. We don't want to accept limits. I mean, even when we're perfectionists, it's neurotic. Oh, I put myself down. I'm never good enough. I never can get anything right. That's why I procrastinate. I can't do anything because I'll never get it done and it won't be any good, and so forth and so on. That's grandiose. Who do you think you are? You're a limited human being. You can't do everything, and you can't do it right the first time, and you can't do it right even perfectly, no matter how many times you do it. Who are you trying to be? I mean, the irony, where we feel putting ourselves down, Really, because we expect so much of ourselves. We have these grandiose notions. We refuse to accept limits. And Karen Horney says, the structure of all patterns of neurosis are the refusal to accept limits. And it's only when we accept our limits and accept the anxiety that goes along with it that then we begin to get some greater measures of health. And we discover that life conspires to undermine our false securities. I mean, the only way to have absolute certainty is to kind of pull out all the plugs that you have in the flow of larger life. That's why authoritarian systems, whether they're political or religious or whatever, always are so close. You always stick with your own kind. You only talk to people who think like you do, and you keep reinforcing yourself back and forth. You're always going to the party meeting or the cell meeting, you know, and you're always reading the literature of the party. Or else you're always going to church, not only on Sunday, but also Sunday school. And then there's also Sunday evening service, and then there's Wednesday prayer service, and there's Thursday Bible study, and then there's Friday fellowship night, and then there's Saturday picnic. I mean, that you know, don't dare get contaminated by these other people, or what's going to happen, your security system is going to start to break down. Why? Because life conspires to break them down. I mean, the only way you can escape it is to stop living. I mean, you think you're living, but you're really kind of just going through the motions. You're in a little box. And we call forth to accept our limits, recognize we don't have it all figured out. There is no permanent security. Here we have no final resting place. Here we have, remember what it says in the Catholic epistles? Here we have no continuing city, but we seek one from above. One that is to come. It's all process, it's all change, it's all risk. Or listen to what psychoanalyst Scott Peck says in his book, The Road Less Traveled. I think there are some copies over in the bookstore. I recommend them heartily, the stuff that Scott Peck is writing. He writes, problems call forth our courage and our wisdom. Indeed, they create our courage and our wisdom. It's only because of problems that we grow mentally and spiritually. When we desire to encourage the growth of the human spirit, we challenge and encourage the human capacity to solve problems, just as in school we deliberately set problems for our children to solve. It is for this reason that wise people learn not to dread, but actually to welcome problems, and actually to welcome the pain of problems. The Road Less Traveled. And it also means, therefore, surrendering our false absolutes, our false gods, our idolatries. That's what the Old Testament calls them, our idolatries. What are idols? They're not statues or that sort of thing. Idols are projections of the human heart, the human mind, and the human imagination that we set up as the answer to our problems and the things that we're going to hang on to and the things that will give us a meaningful life. And they're just projections out of ourselves. That's our idolatry. And therefore, the first commandment is ultimately the deepest commandment and the final commandment. You shall have no other gods except me. And that means living life as it comes from my hand. And that's in risk. And openness. So there's a kind of hard-nosed realism, I think, in Christian faith, to stand before God and surrender false absolutes and to accept life from His hands, not knowing what it all is going to add up to or where it's all going. And it's how to live with the problems, too. Peter Slater writes, the mature judges are those who can live with ambiguity and uncertainty. Yeah. What about abortion? Remember those questions? Is homosexuality a sin? How do we deal with all kinds of turbulence and change? What about nuclear disarmament? Peter Slater, the mature judges are those who can live with ambiguity and uncertainty. Instead of having the answer. Deceptive certainties and phony securities tempt us from without and within. They seduce us away from a life lived under God. But God calls us to follow him, to trust him, and to move out into life with him. He is life itself, truth itself, goodness itself, maturity itself, meaningfulness itself. But more deeply, he is graciousness itself. It's interesting to note that most of the time the Old and New Testament say that God is like one thing or another. He is like a lord or a shepherd or a father or a mother hen. But one of the few places asserting what God is says, God is love. He's not like love. He is love. The love that is indicated here means unconditional graciousness, self-giving love, unqualified compassion. This is the sum and substance of what alone is unqualified and certain and absolute. We are called to trust in that love and place ourselves under it. When we do so, we are given an unqualified certainty and an unshakable security. We find refuge in the love of God, which embraces us in our ambiguous, troubled, and death-oriented world. Whoever lives in love lives in God and God in him, the epistle goes on. Trusting that love and placing ourselves under it, we are given an unqualified certainty and an unshakable security. Quote, love is made complete among us so that we will have confidence on the day of judgment, because in this world we are like him. There is no fear in love, but perfect love drives out fear. End of quote. That's verses 17 and 18 of that passage. And therefore we learn to be resilient and tolerant. We learn to accept people and their differences, and we learn to accept ourselves and our failure. We love because he first loved us, says the epistle. If anyone says, I love God, and yet hates his brother, he is a liar. For anyone who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. That, I think, is the key, and that's the call. And we'll look at this a little further tomorrow. The gospel is the call to what Martin Marty calls convinced openness.